Thanks for tuning in. I'm Claire Hennessy. The Allegory of the Cave, or Plato's Cave, delivers the most unforgettable and most beautiful image on the effects of education on the soul, presented as a dialogue between Plato's brother Glaucon and his mentor Socrates. In our previous episodes, we have approached quite a few allegories according to both Western and Eastern narrative traditions. As a literary device or artistic form, an allegory is a narrative or visual representation in which a character, place, or event can be interpreted to represent a hidden meaning with moral or political significance. Authors have used allegory throughout history in all forms of art to illustrate or convey complex ideas and concepts in ways that are comprehensible or striking to its viewers, readers, or listeners. Writers and speakers typically use allegories to convey semi-hidden or complex meanings through symbolic figures, actions, imagery, or events, which together create the moral, spiritual, or political meaning the author wishes to convey. Again, the allegory of the cave is delivered within the Socratic method known as Lankos, which is an effective way of dramatizing the process of philosophizing. Such a narrative technique renders Plato's writing all the time beautiful and enlightening among world civilization. While this episode provides an opportunity to read the original allegory and come to the closest understanding of it, what you will hear is the original text read by Dr. Jim Nielsen, former faculty member in Arts and Humanities at University of British Columbia.
Next, then, compare the effect of education and that of the lack of it on our nature to an experience like this. Imagine human beings living in an underground cave-like dwelling, with an entrance a long way up that is open to the light and as wide as the cave itself. They have been there since childhood, with their necks and legs fettered, so that they are fixed in the same place, able to see only in front of them, because their fetter prevents them from turning their heads around. Light is provided by a fire burning far above and behind them. Between the prisoners and the fire, there is an elevated road stretching. Imagine that along this road, a low wall has been built like the screen in front of people that is provided by puppeteers, and above which they show their puppets. I'm imagining it. Also imagine, then, that there are people alongside the wall carrying multifarious artifacts that project above it, statues of people and other animals made of stone, wood, and every material. And as you would expect, some of the carriers are talking and some are silent. It is a strange image you're describing, and strange prisoners. They are like us. I mean, in the first place, do you think these prisoners have ever seen anything of themselves and one another besides the shadows that the fire casts on the wall of the cave in front of them? How could they if they have had to keep their heads motionless throughout life? What about the things carried along the wall? Isn't the same true where they are concerned?
Of course.
And if they could engage in discussion with one another, don't you think they would assume that the words they used applied to the things they see passing in front of them?
They would have to.
What if their prison also had an echo from the wall facing them? When one of the carriers passing along the wall spoke, do you think they would believe that anything other than the shadow passing them was speaking?
I do not, by Zeus.
All in all, then, what the prisoners would take for true reality is nothing other than the shadows of those artifacts.
That's entirely inevitable.
Consider, then, what, being released from their bonds and cured of their foolishness, would naturally be like if something like this should happen to them. When one was freed and suddenly compelled to stand up, turn his neck around, walk, and look up toward the light, he would be pained by doing all these things and be unable to see the things whose shadows he had seen before because of the flashing lights. What do you think he would say if we told him that what he had seen before was silly nonsense, but that now, because he is a bit closer to what is and is turned toward things that are more, he sees more correctly? In particular, if we pointed to each of the things passing by and compelled him to answer what each of them is, Don't you think he would be puzzled and believe that the things he saw earlier were more truly real than the ones he was being shown? Much more so. And if he were compelled to look at the light itself, wouldn't his eyes be pained, and wouldn't he turn around and flee toward the things he is able to see and believe that they are really clearer than the ones he's being shown? He would. And if someone dragged him by force away from there, along the rough, steep, upward path, and did not let him go until he had dragged him into the light of the sun, wouldn't he be pained and angry at being treated that way? And when he came into the light, wouldn't he have his eyes filled with sunlight and be unable to see a single one of the things now said to be truly real? No, he would not be able to, at least not right away. He would need time to get adjusted, I suppose, if he is going to see the things in the world above. At first he would see shadows most easily, then images of men and other things in water, then the things themselves. From these, it would be easier for him to go on to look at the things in the sky and the sky itself at night, gazing at the light of the stars and the moon, than during the day, gazing at the sun and the light of the sun. Of course. Finally, I suppose, he would be able to see the sun. Not reflections of it in water or some alien place, but the sun just by itself in its own place, and be able to look at it and see what it is like. He would have to. After that, he would already be able to conclude about it that it provides the seasons and the years, governs everything in the visible world, and is in some way the cause of all the things that he and his fellows used to see. That would clearly be his next step. What about when he reminds himself of his first dwelling place? What passed for wisdom there and his fellow prisoners? Don't you think he would count himself happy for the change and pity the others? Certainly. And if there had been honors, praises, or prizes among them for the one who was sharpest at identifying the shadows as they passed by, and was best able to remember which usually came earlier, which later, and which simultaneously, and who was thus best able to prophesize the future, do you think that our man would desire these rewards, or envy those among the prisoners who were honored and held power? Or do you think he would feel with Homer that he would much prefer to work the earth as a serf for another man, a man without possessions of his own, and go through any sufferings rather than share their beliefs and live as they do? Yes, I think he would rather suffer anything than live like that. Consider this too, then. If this man went back down into the cave and sat down in his same seat, wouldn't his eyes be filled with darkness, coming suddenly out of the sun like that? Certainly. Now, if he had to compete once again with the perpetual prisoners in recognizing the shadows, while his sight was still dim and before his eyes had recovered, and if the time required for readjustment was not short, wouldn't he provoke ridicule? Wouldn't it be said of him that he had returned from his upward journey with his eyes ruined, and that it is not worthwhile even to try to travel upward? And as for anyone who tried to free the prisoners and lead them upward, if they could somehow get their hands on him, wouldn't they kill him? They certainly would. This image, my dear Glaucon, must be fitted together as a whole with what we said before. The realm revealed through sight should be likened to the prison dwelling, and the light of the fire inside it to the sun's power. And if you think of the upward journey and the seeing of things above as the upward journey of the soul to the intelligible realm, you won't mistake my intention, since it is what you wanted to hear about. Only the God knows whether it is true, but this is how these phenomena seem to me. In the knowable realm, the last thing to be seen is the form of the good, and it is seen only with toil and trouble. Once one has seen it, however, one must infer that it is the cause of all that is correct and beautiful in anything, that in the visible realm it produces both light and its source, and that in the intelligible realm it controls and provides truth and understanding, and that anyone who is to act sensibly in private or public must see it.
I agree so far as I'm able.
Come on, then, and join me in this further thought. You should not be surprised that the ones who get to this point are not willing to occupy themselves with human affairs, but that, on the contrary, their souls are always eager to spend their time above. I mean, that is surely what we would expect if indeed the image I described before is also accurate here. It is what we would expect. What about when someone coming from looking at divine things looks to the evils of human life? Do you think it is surprising that he behaves awkwardly and appears completely ridiculous? If, while his sight is still dim and he has not yet become accustomed to the darkness around him, he is compelled, either in the courts or elsewhere, to compete about the shadows of justice, or about the statues of which they are the shadows, and to dispute the ways these things are understood by people who have never seen justice itself. It is not surprising at all. On the contrary, anyone with any sense, at any rate, would remember that eyes may be confused in two ways and from two causes, when they change from the light into the darkness, or from the darkness into the light. If he kept in mind that the same applies to the soul, then when he saw a soul disturbed and unable to see something, he would not laugh absurdly. Instead, he would see whether it had come from a brighter life and was dimmed through not having yet become accustomed to the dark, or from greater ignorance into greater light and was dazzled by the increased brilliance. Then he would consider the first soul happy in its experience in life, and pity the latter. But even if he wanted to ridicule it, at least his ridiculing it would make him less ridiculous than ridiculing a soul that had come from the light above. That's an entirely reasonable claim. Then here is how we must think about these matters, if that is true. Education is not what some people boastfully profess it to be. They say that they can pretty much put knowledge into souls that lack it, like putting sight into blind eyes. Yes, they do say that. But here is what our present account shows about this power to learn that is present in everyone's soul, and the instrument with which each of us learns. Just as an eye cannot be turned around from the darkness to light except by turning the whole body, so this instrument must be turned around from what comes to be, together with the whole soul, until it is able to bear to look at what is and at the brightest thing that is, the one that we call the good. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Of this, then, of this very turning around, there would be a craft concerned with how this instrument can be most easily and effectively turned around. Not of putting sight into it. On the contrary, it takes for granted that sight is there, though not turned in the right way or looking where it should look, and contrives to redirect it appropriately. That's probably right.
The Allegory of the Cave is based on Book 6 Analogy of the Sun and Line Theory, in which the human condition is described as only seeing shadows instead of real people, animals, and objects, and believing these shadows of those artifacts are truth. It portrays Plato's view on knowledge and reality, and describes the state of philosophy in the actual world. Socrates, after being urged by Glaucon, defines goodness and proposes instead an analogy through a child of goodness. Socrates reveals this child of goodness to be the sun, proposing that, just as the sun illuminates, bestowing the ability to see and be seen by the eye, with its light, so the idea of goodness illumines the intelligible with truth, leading some scholars to believe this forms a connection of the sun and the intelligible world within the realm of the allegory of the cave. When Socrates describes a group of people who have lived chained to an empty wall of a cave all their lives, these prisoners are actually every one of us. The shadows are the prisoner's reality, but are not accurate representations of the real world. The shadows represent actually the fragment of reality that we can normally perceive through our senses, while the objects under the sun represent the true forms of objects that we can only perceive through reason. The goal of education is therefore to drag every man as far out of the cave as possible. Education should not aim at putting knowledge into the soul, but at turning the soul toward right desires. The overarching goal of the city, therefore, is to educate those with the right natures so that they can turn their minds sharply toward the form of the good. Once they have done this, they cannot remain contemplating the form of the good forever. They must return periodically into the cave and rule there. They need periodically to turn away from the forms, to return to the shadows to help other prisoners. What is form, and how do we understand it? And how and why we should read Plato's Cave? The theory of forms, or theory of ideas, is a philosophical concept that renders the physical world as not as real or true as timeless, absolute, unchangeable ideas. Ideas in this sense are the non-physical essence of all things, of which objects and matter in the physical world are merely imitations. Plato suggests that these forms are the only objects of study that can provide knowledge. The theory itself is contested from within Plato's dialogues, and it is a general point of controversy in philosophy. Nevertheless, it is considered to be a classical solution to the problem of universals. The early Greek concept of form precedes attested philosophical usage and is represented by a number of words mainly having to do with vision, sight, and appearance. Plato uses these aspects of sight and appearance from the early Greek concept of form in his dialogues to explain the forms and the good. The definition of the good is a perfect, eternal, and changeless form, existing outside space and time. The first references that are seen in the Republic to the form of the good are within the conversation between Glaucon and Socrates, when, trying to answer such difficult questions pertaining to the definition of justice, Plato identifies that we should not introduce every form of difference and the sameness in nature. Instead, we must focus on the one form of sameness and difference that was relevant to the particular ways of life themselves, which is the form of the good. This form is the basis for understanding all other forms. It is what allows us to understand everything else. Through the conversation between Socrates and Glaucon, Plato analogizes the form of the good with the sun as it is what allows us to see things. Plato describes how the sun allows for sight, but he makes a very important distinction that the sun is not sight, but it is the cause of the sight itself. As the sun is in the visible realm, the form of good is in the intelligible realm. It is what gives truth to the things known and the power to know to the knower. It is not only the cause of knowledge and truth, it is also an object of knowledge. Plato identifies how the forms of good allows for the cognizance to understand such difficult concepts as justice. He identifies knowledge and truth as important, but through Socrates says, good is yet more prized. He then proceeds to explain, although the good is not being, it is superior to it in rank and power. It is what provides for knowledge and truth. Socrates explains how the philosopher is like a prisoner who is freed from the cave and comes to understand that the shadows on the wall are actually not the direct source of the images seen. A philosopher aims to understand and perceive the higher levels of reality. Unworthy are the other inmates of the cave, who do not even desire to leave their prison, for they know no better life. Scholars debate the possible interpretations of the allegory of the cave, either looking at it from an epistemological standpoint, one based on the study of how Plato believes we come to know things, or through a political lens. Much of the scholarship on the allegory falls between the following two perspectives, with some completely independent of either: the epistemological view and the political view, fathered by Richard Louis Nettleship and A.S. Ferguson, respectively, tend to be discussed the most frequently. Nettleship interprets the allegory of the cave as representative of our innate intellectual incapacity in order to contrast our lesser understanding with that of the philosopher, as well as an allegory about people who are unable or unwilling to seek truth and wisdom. Ferguson, on the other hand, bases his interpretation of the allegory on the claim that the cave is an allegory of human nature and that it symbolizes the opposition between the philosopher and the corruption of the prevailing political condition. Cleavages have emerged within these respective camps of thought, however. Much of the modern scholarly debate surrounding the allegory has emerged from Martin Heidegger's exploration of the allegory and philosophy as a whole through the lens of human freedom in his book, The Essence of Human Freedom, An Introduction to Philosophy and the Essence of Truth, on Plato's cave allegory and Theaetetus. In response, Hannah Arendt, an advocate of the political interpretation of the allegory, suggests that through the allegory, Plato wanted to apply his own theory of ideas to politics. Conversely, Heidegger argues that the essence of truth is a way of being and not an object. Arendt criticized Heidegger's interpretation of the allegory, writing that Heidegger is off base in using the cave simile to interpret and criticize Plato's theory of ideas. In this way, the cave leads to many fundamental questions, including the origin of knowledge, the problem of representation, and the nature of reality itself. For theologians, the ideal forms exist in the mind of a creator. For philosophers of language viewing the forms as linguistic concepts, the theory illustrates the problem of grouping concrete things under abstract terms. And others still wonder whether we can really know that the things outside the cave are any more real than the shadows. As we go about our lives, can we be confident in what we think we know? Perhaps one day a glimmer of light may punch a hole in your most basic assumptions. Will you break free to struggle towards the light, even if it costs you your friends and family, or stick with comfortable and familiar illusions? Truth or habit, light or shadow, hard choices. But if it's any consolation, you are not alone. There are lots of us down here. Thank you so much for listening.